If you could recommend one thing every aspiring wildlife filmmaker or young person should do every day to get closer to their goals, what would it be?
Sounds kind of obvious, but go and make wildlife films. Like if that's what you want to do, we live in an amazing time when everyone has access to a camera. It's very easy to get obsessed with, you know, the latest technology and, you know, the cameras that I'm fortunate enough to use on my Disney Plus series that, you know, some of them are, you know, $50,000-$100,000. You don't need those to start and to make great wildlife films. Yeah. Everyone has a, you know, camera in their phone. Start with that at the very least. Get out and make wildlife films, because that's how you'll learn how to do it. And it means, you know, everyone always talks about a lucky break, and of course you need those. I've been very lucky to have many of those. But you when you have those lucky breaks, you need to have done the work so that you can then get those opportunities, take advantage of them. I meet people all the time that, you know, I'm very lucky that they want to work with me on my show. And my first question is, what have you done to show me that, you know, you've got initiative and drive and passion for it? And yeah, the people that go, oh, I'm still waiting for my lucky break, I'm like, but the people that go, oh, I made this film about, you know, this little nature reserve down the road from me where there's foxes and badgers, and I filmed it from this angle, you're like, ha, this person's hungry. That would be my answer.
Yeah. Luck is when preparation meets opportunity, right? And
love it. Where'd you get that? I need that on a t-shirt.
Oh, I listen to too many podcasts. Like some podcasts.
My favorite one, I worked with a guide in Canada called Mike, and he said, when you're looking for wildlife, luck is spelt W-O-R-K. That's also a good one.
That is a good one. Am I correct in saying that you used to photograph fish on your school grounds using underwater camera housing that you made yourself?
I used to have pet fish and I would photograph them. Actually the first photography competition I ever won, don't get too excited by this, it was the monthly practical fish keeping magazine competition. I don't need an Oscar now. I just thought I've already won. So I had fish, photographed them. There was a little river that ran through part where I went to school, and I used to jump in that river all the time and photograph the pike and swans and all sorts. Yeah, I think everyone thought it was a bit weird, but
yeah, I was going to ask. You know, have you felt different at different points in your life? Maybe when you were doing stuff like that, and everyone else in your school's probably thinking you're an absolute weirdo. How did you deal with that kind of indifference between you versus, you know, the regular people?
You know, I think it's easy to like overanalyze things and be like, oh, what did I think? What was it? I knew that I was obsessed with wildlife, and I thought that was more important than what other people thought. And what I'm really excited by now is that, like, being interested in nature is now like quite cool at school. Like I've been back to give school talks, and like people that aren't interested in the environment and like, you know, yeah, just like those kinds of things. Like, I don't know, using single-use plastics or whatever. That's like standard. And if you don't do that, like, you're now the loser.
Yeah.
It's a total shift, which is awesome. But I think probably a big part of it was my mom and dad were always really kind of supportive of me, like following my passions. They could see I was like into this, and I think that was big part, and I was very fortunate to have their support. I think also, like, one thing I realized was photography is such a great way of channeling your obsession in something.
100%.
And by accident, I realized that, like, people that think I'm weird, I can get them interested in what I am interested in by showing them pictures of it. Like, my friends thought I was weird, but the moment you're like, oh no, like, look, there's this bird called kingfisher, and you walk past a little river where it lives, and you've missed it every day, and it's like fluorescent blue and orange. Isn't that really cool? And you kind of see their eyes light up. And again, I've trained, so I can overanalyze stuff. It's easy to read too much into things, but I think that was me subconsciously realizing, like, something that I do now as a job, which is, my job is to get people interested in things that I care about. And yeah, photography, filmmaking is such a good way to do that.
Yeah, I think passion is infectious, even if you don't, you know, necessarily are interested in the thing that person's interested in. Have you ever seen the Isle of Man TT, the motor rally?
Yeah, you
know, and like, have you seen there's like these people in these ponchos, it's like absolutely pouring down with rain, and then you just go,
they're in it,
and then the crowd go crazy.
It's like that guy, I can't remember his name, the like train spotter guy.
Yeah.
What's his name? Anyway, that guy. I don't care about trains, okay? Not that interested. But I want to watch his stuff because, like, just seeing how pumped he is about trains, that is amazing entertainment in itself. But, like, yeah, you learn stuff from people that are knowledgeable and passionate about things.
100%. And what's the biggest misconception about wildlife filmmaking that people never get to see on screen?
I think people have this idea that you sort of just, you know, when you're making wildlife documentaries, you just sort of prance around the world, having all these lovely, magical encounters. The reality is that's like less than 1% of the job, sadly. I wish it was more. 99% of the time is sort of problem solving and waiting and being uncomfortable and bored. But that 1% makes it all worth it.
Yeah, I remember in the shark documentary when you're sitting there on the boat and you're describing it, just kind of how like bored and frustrated you are. And it's like the, what was it? The meme where it's like, what my mom thinks I do.
Yeah.
What I actually do. And it's just you waiting there for the great whites to show up.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the other misconception is that to make wildlife documentaries, you need to be patient. I'm such an impatient person. I think far more important are two other P's, passion and persistence. Mm-hmm. I think that those two skills are what makes you good at filming wildlife.
Yeah, 100%. And I looked at your blog from 2015 and 2016 onwards, and that passion's definitely been there for that long.
God, what are you? I must have written
it. It's really good. No, but for any aspiring wildlife filmmakers, they should check your blog out because you can see the progression and the opportunities that you made yourself. And what I was going to ask is, what advice would you have for young people who want to make their own opportunities, but don't know where to start with it?
Well, as I said, like, go make films. And you know, I find a film that someone's made about the pigeons down the road from where they live far more impressive than someone that has, you know, gone to the Masai Mara to photograph lions. There are, of course, amazing ways to film those lines in new ways. And if you've kind of hustled a cool opportunity, then great, do that. So I would say, yeah, make films about something that is close, not necessarily close to you. Make films about somewhere that you can make your local patch. And obviously, most easily, that is down the road from you. But if you can, like, hustle some cool opportunity to, like, when I was at university, I used to live in the basement of a wildlife guide on Vancouver Island. He'd sort of look after me, make sure I didn't get eaten. And I'd take pictures for his, for him. And then in return, I got to go out and sort of see all these amazing, animals and learn from him. And that was like a cool opportunity that I hustled. But I guess my point is, because I was there for a long time, I did 2-3 month, windows. I made that place my local patch. Like, that's what you need to do to get like cool animal behavior is, spend so much time in a place that you know every corner of it, you start to be able to predict the animals and what they're going to do. That's really the key to getting cool stuff.
Yeah, when you were on probably the many times you've been on a platform in a tree, one of the previous shows, you said that you'd rather stay in one location for many months rather than hopping to different ones. Is that the reason? So you can kind of observe the animals and know their behavioral patterns.
You want to get to know them. I mean, it's just like, if you were trying to make a film about people, like, the best way to do that is sort of, maybe become friends with them, hang out with them. Yeah. Hopping around is a very different style of making films and not one that I'm very good at. I mean, I also hate traveling.
Really?
Oh yeah, it's a pain in the ass. Like going through airports with loaded bags, and I like getting to a place and getting
hungering down. Yeah. Speaking of the kind of when you went to Vancouver Island. Steve Winter told me that you also went to a rainforest and did something similar. Is that correct, or is he getting it mixed up?
Yeah, no, no, he's right. So, between my second and final year at university, I wanted to photograph in jungles. How did that actually come about the first time? I was approached by a bird watching magazine that said, "Yeah, will you come on this trip, and photograph, such different birds." They were trying to promote. It was like a tourism trip. They were trying to promote tourism to Manu National Park in Peru. It's part of Peruvian Amazon. And yeah, amazing opportunity, very cool. I don't know how they found me, but it must have been through social media or something. So I went on that, made all the contacts, and then was like, okay, now I can come back and run. You know, it was like a 10-day trip or something. We were hopping between loads of places, traveling lots. So I was like, how do I make this my patch? So, met all these cool wildlife guides and the lodges and stuff out there, the tourism operators, and then said, right, following summer, I want to come for like 4 months. Can you put me up in your hotel? And I'll in your hotel, very kind of, exaggerated, fancy tent, we'll call it. Look after me, you know, come my logistics and stuff, and I'll take pictures for you. So I did that, and I hopped between all these different, places. And, I was a student, didn't have, money to, pay what tourists have to pay to do that. So yeah, it was a way to kind of hustle to move between the places. And actually I didn't tell, there was like 4 lodges that I worked with. I didn't tell each lodge about the other lodges because I wanted them to like feel special. So when it came to like leaving day, they were like, "Oh, so you're going back to the city?" I was like, "No, I'm just gonna like hitchhike down river." And that went really badly a couple times, but got there in the end. But yeah, long-winded way of saying make opportunities and make places your local patch, so that's how you get good stuff.
Yeah, that's really cool that you're able to do that as a student and be that resourceful. And am I correct in saying that you also got a first as a student and your practical, you got the best, you were the best in the class at something to do with your...
Yeah, I'm complete nerd. I think I got the best science student or something. Yeah, complete loser.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
You know that thing of like persistence and working hard. I don't think I was far from the cleverest person in my year, but I probably worked one of the hardest, and that's why the stuff that I happen to be good at, it's because I work hard, not necessarily because I'm naturally particularly good at it. I think that's like a important lesson that I've learned is like just try really hard, and so you get good at stuff.
So were you working really hard on your course and then also balancing that with trying to go out as much as possible with the camera?
Yeah. I mean, the whole time I was at uni, I was, trying to photograph wildlife in my free time. And I remember me and my best buddy, Matt, every Sunday morning, we would go get up at like 4 in the morning and go wander around the back streets of Bristol, trying to photograph foxes. And we did it on Sunday mornings because that's when it was really quiet and you'd always get the best behavior. But we did that for like, I don't know, like the whole of the, well, we did it pretty much the whole time we were at uni. We were like religiously up at 4 a.m. on Sunday morning. How many students do you know that did that? If you want something, go do it. And like, especially if you're like doing a course, like you got this amazing time where you don't have the pressure of like life. So if you are uni or wherever, like use that opportunity to like experiment and make mistakes, because as soon as you graduate, like a lot of my friends were just like, life has now hit me. Whereas I sort of had almost a 3-year head start because I've been thinking about that since day one.
Yeah. So did you have that almost your blueprint or journey as mapped out as you could be? Did you always think I don't want to do a 9-to-5 office job?
Oh, I mean, that's never even entered my brain. Yeah, no, I've always wanted to, I grew up watching the David Attenborough documentaries. I always thought that's something I want to do. I'm going to figure out how to do that. I think we, it's changed a lot. But like, I remember when I was at school, like getting a proper job, you know, in quotes, was what you were told to do. And the idea of like doing a job that was your passion was a bit more like sort of waffly and artsy. Whereas now I think that's really changed, kind of culturally, you know, with the creator economy and loads of stuff. So I think that's changed for the better. But yeah, I'd say it doesn't have to be wildlife film. Like, yeah, if you're fortunate enough to be in a position where you can choose what you do, like choose to do something that you love and you're passionate about, because you've got to work like a lot of your life. So you may as well make it something that you enjoy. And it also means you'll be good at it.
Yeah, 100%. We spend 50% of our time awake working. So, you know, you better make the most of it.
Totally.
Yeah. And what's the best advice you've been given from the greats like Paul Nicklin, Steve Winter and Attenborough that you still use today? What advice has stuck with you?
Big thing I learned from Steve was that it's all about persistence. Like that is the key. Be passionate, sure, but be persistent. Like you look at his most iconic pictures, like his one of the, I'm in LA right now, just down the road from here, he shot iconic picture of a mountain lion P-22 in front of the Hollywood sign. That was a camera shot. He's setting up and maintaining his cameras for 13 months before P-22, that was the name of that mountain lion, walked past the cameras. One of the flashes didn't go off. 13 months, you wait for that cat to walk past the camera and the camera fails. So he's like, okay, well, I'm just going to keep going. And he, you know, got everything working again. And then after 15 months, the cat walked past and he got that iconic picture. Like people say, oh, I'm such a lucky photo. There is no luck involved in like maintaining a camera for 15 months. Yeah, that's persistence.
Yeah. I didn't realize that the Hollywood lights aren't on. So in that photo, you can see the Hollywood sign. And is that from the flash that he used?
No. So the cat is lit up by the flashes. The Hollywood sign, it's a long exposure. So I think it's like a four-second exposure, 2-second exposure. So it's really cleverly lit because it's, you know, with the 4-second exposure, that foreground where the cat is, you've got real ghosting problems because like you fire those flashes and then obviously the shutter is open for the rest of that time. So the cat's then going to have this weird streak behind it. So he chose a place where the foreground was really dark. There's very little ambient light, which means you can have a long shutter speed. Your flashes will be the only thing that illuminates the foreground. So you can freeze the cat. And then that long shutter means you get some light in the sky. And yeah, it's the light of the city. There might be a bit of moon as well, but the light of the city lighting up the Hollywood sign in the background.
Yeah, so good. And what mistakes do you see people commonly make when they're networking or looking for mentors, and what should they try instead?
Good question. I think a lot of people forget the most important thing, which is like, we all want to work with our friends, right? Especially in wildlife film, because, you know, when we're on a shoot, we live on top of each other. That is the most important thing. How good you are at your job is a secondary thing. I would rather go away with someone that I really liked and they were okay at their job versus someone that is a bit of a dick excuse my language, not a nice person and really good at their job. And so I think when people are in like a networking situation, I see people get like really like fired up and like, let me tell you about this. And I'm just like, chill. I want to be your friend. Let's be friends. And then there's a way of being friend. And like, then you can tell me what you do. Like, I think the other really interesting thing is, get good at listening and asking questions, because when you meet someone, you know what you know. You don't know what they know. So are you telling stories or are you like asking questions? And that's something that I really watch when I'm trying to like steer if I'm going to get on with someone. Is it a group setting? Like what are they doing? How are they operating? Are they deeply curious? Because when we're in the field, I spend the whole time just like being a sponge, like absorbing information from all the really talented people that are around me. Sure, like, you know, tell some stories, entertain people. That's, you know, give and take. That's how, you know, you become friends with people, or sort of show that, you know, you're capable of doing something. But yeah, you know what you know. You don't know what someone else knows. Ask questions, be curious.
100%, 100% agree. And if you do take that fiery approach and you're like, let me tell you about myself, it seems a bit more transactional, and is what you're saying, kind of do the opposite, become friends with people rather than just make it tit for tat.
What?
Hey guys, first of all, I want to say thank you. There's one person who's been sharing the podcast more than anybody else, and that is you. The only reason why this podcast continues to grow is because you are sharing it. And my only ask is, if this podcast has provided value to you, or you think it'll provide value to somebody else, then if you could send them a DM of the link or a screenshot to the show, that would genuinely make my day. And it's the only way the podcast will continue to grow. That's my only ask of you. Thank you very much.
I think I remember when I was at university, that guy Matt that I mentioned, that I went to photograph foxes with, we were like both trying to get into wildlife film at university. And we actually came up with the three rules of networking, such illusions. Three rules of networking. And let me see if I can remember these. So we said, never lie. You know, people are often creative with the truth. Okay, that's, you know, some argument for that. But like, don't lie, because you're going to get found out. The second one was like, be a nice person. Like, that's really important. Be a cool person. I say be a nice person, not a cool person. The third one is never miss an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Like, I see all the time people are presented with opportunities, or I will ring up someone out of the blue and be like, hey, I've got this thing. I've been thinking about you because I know you keep emailing me asking if I've got anything on. I've thought of you, there's this. And they'll go, oh, sorry, I can't do that, blah, blah, blah. Now, fair enough, when you are a bit more experienced, have a few more years under your belt, work-life balance, great, cool. But like, if you're starting out and you get an opportunity, drop everything. Because if you really want it, you need to do that. Unfortunately, like, there's a huge line of people queuing up behind you. So yeah, those are the three rules. I say don't try and be cool, because a buddy of mine, Jacob Collier, the musician, I was watching an interview with him recently, and he was saying a really cool thing he was taught was don't try and be cool, try and be warm. And I think that's a really nice way of thinking about it when you meet people.
Yeah, 100%. And why do you think people do, if they've been spamming you with emails, why do they suddenly back off once they actually get the real opportunity? Do you think they just get scared, or is it just...
No, I think a lot of people like the idea of filming wildlife from the reality. Like, as we talked about, you know, you were asking what's the biggest misconception. Yeah, I think people think it's just going to be prancing around filming animals, but that's sadly not the reality. Even the so-called dream jobs have the hard bits. You know that phrase like, oh, do a job you love and then you'll never work a day in your life? That is the biggest load of rubbish I've ever heard. You're gonna work so hard, and you might even work harder than if you have a normal job.
Yeah, I think Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, said, like, repeated that. He agreed with you, and then he also was like, but the tools in your hand will feel seamlessly, like, much easier or something. So, like, it's going to feel like work, but it's going to be more fun whilst you're doing it, or a bit easier whilst you're doing it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And have you ever felt like, have you ever been criticized quite a lot at any periods of your career? And
all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. How have you dealt with that?
No, I think criticism's a good thing when presented constructively. I think in terms of, like, you know, Instagram haters will come at that first. Like, yeah, I mean, if you're going to be in the public eye and present nature documentaries, you need a thick skin. You know, not everyone likes everyone. You know, that you can't please them all. But I found a good way of, like, dealing with it is when someone says something really nasty, you know, in the press or, you know, on Instagram, whatever, either just ignore it, or because I'm not very good at ignoring stuff, like, I like look at, okay, here's that person, What have they experienced? How have they formed that opinion? And 9 times out of 10, pretty quick, you can realize, oh, right, okay. They have a bee in their bonnet about something else, or they really don't like someone you worked with before, or they wanted to do something you're doing and they're jealous. Or
yeah.
There's usually an explanation. And then actually when you're like, oh, I actually just feel a bit sorry for you, yeah. It completely takes the sting out of them. I think the other thing is, if you're going to respond, because some of the haters, I just can't help myself, got to reply. make sure that whatever your comeback is, you kill them with kindness.
Yeah.
Don't escalate things.
Yeah.
Just be really kind. I usually use copious amounts of sarcasm in my kindness as well. Thank you so much for your feedback. I really appreciate your
opinion. Yeah, yeah.
but I would like to inform you that XYZ. So there's that. In terms of other criticism, yeah. I people within the industry that I really respect. I've had feedback about stuff that they didn't like or thought I'd do better or whatever. And yeah, I think when you get feedback, you can agree with it, disagree with it, take it on board, whatever. I think usually the important thing to remember is like the context of the criticism. Like, no one likes being criticized, right?
Yeah.
But it's important to like try and take a step back and go, okay, whilst I don't agree, I think they're being mean, or I disagree with them, is there any element of truth that I can learn from? Because usually when I disagree with someone I work with, you know, they've said something that they didn't like what I did or thought I could do something better, often you'll be like, I don't agree with you, but maybe I didn't, your solution is not the right one, but you've identified a problem. Dealing with criticism is difficult. Yeah, you know, we've all got, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And with the Instagram comment thing, the thing that I try and remember is like, no one tends to hate you from above. Like, you're not going to see David Attenborough hating on you for, you know, whatever work you've done.
No one hates you from above. Interesting. That's very homely, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I've had some people that.
Oh, really?
Pretty significant, saying some not nice things, but often it comes from, they got stuff going on.
Yeah, well, another one would be, I guess, what's another one? If you get no hate, you're not successful. Maybe that's more applicable to that one. Like, at least they're thinking about you in the first place.
I heard a really good one about online haters, actually. I was watching an interview with Tom Holland, and he was saying, like, if you've got a problem with me, open your phone book and call me and tell me about it. If you open your phone book and I'm not in it, maybe you don't know me well enough to be saying what you're saying. I was like,
that's money.
Spider-Man's good.
Yeah. So let's talk about your latest series, Sharks Up Close. What surprised you most during its filming, and what do you want the public to take from this film?
Well, we went into it thinking that Great White Sharks, that was our plan to film Great White Sharks. The filming them was going to be pretty straightforward. So we're going to be lost in them. Turned out that wasn't the case. They're really hard to film. And the biggest thing I learned is that, you know, we've spent so long worrying about great white sharks when really we should be worried for them. They have a lot of challenges, and it was sort of the best way for us to investigate that, because the investigation into why they weren't there was totally natural. That was unplanned. We planned to just go there and film them. And I think the best sort of environmental stories, conservation stories, are ones aren't conservation stories. They are the story. It's not just, and now so the conservation scene.
Yeah.
And we had some amazing shark encounters and encounters with other animals as well. So that was the biggest thing I learned.
Yeah. And what's one surprising fact about great whites that most people probably don't know?
That is a good question. One surprising fact. Well, I would say probably that they are famous for hunting seals, you know, big mammals, dolphins, seals. That's what they're designed to do as adults. But actually, they have a very broad diet, and a big part of their diet, especially when they're smaller, is other species of sharks. And one of the real challenges that they have along the South African coast is that those smaller shark species, sharks like the smoothhound shark and the superfin shark, they are being really aggressively overfished And, you know, when you take away a shark's prey, the sharks themselves are protected. But if you're not protecting their prey, then you're not protecting them. I've just realized this is very on brand. I've got a shark awesome. T-shirt on. So that is, I guess, the most surprising thing is that, great whites don't just eat seals. They have this really broad diet. And a big part of that is smaller species of shark.
Yeah. Dude, I absolutely love your choice of T-shirts, by the way. Like, in the documentaries, they're so good with like the sharks and the whales on. It's awesome.
You've got to have animal T-shirts. Yeah, novelty animal T-shirts. That's the way forward.
Yeah, and how do sharks or great whites hunt? Is it like they smell the blood like in Barry in Finding Nemo when he smells Dory's blood and his eyes switch on? Or like, how do they do it?
Fish are our friends, not food. I think they've Bruce, actually.
Bruce.
Yeah. Sorry, Finding Nemo, one of my favorite films. So I'm going to
call
it very much. They have these amazing sensory receptors and they've got a really good sense of smell. They can detect electrical fields using this really cool sense in their nose called the ampulla of Lorenzini. It's like electroreception. So they can detect prey in the dark or poor visibility water.
Wow.
And they actually have pretty decent eyesight as well. So a lot of their hunting is also visual. So they will typically ambush stuff from underneath. But they can also smash stuff from the side. They're these amazing ambush hunters. I think what's also surprising is for a lot of people is that, they're actually very calculated. They have this reputation for being these sort of mindless killers, but that's not true. Yeah, they can't afford to get injured. And so they're actually quite tentative about their hunting. But once they kind of decide they're going for something, they come in really hard and fast because it's all about trying to immobilize your prey. If you're hunting a seal, it's got a dangerous bite. You want to make sure you take it out. And that's really the problem when humans are attacked by great whites. It's a case of mistaken identity. But they come in so hard and fast because they don't want to get bitten back. By the time they've hit you, bitten you once, realized that you're not what they wanted to eat, which is a seal, let go and gone, I don't like you, swim off. Well, chances are, you've lost a leg or have catastrophic injuries. Very rarely does a great white attack and actually eat the person.
It's
usually a bite.
Yeah.
Wasn't what I was after, swim away. So then the key thing, and when we go into this in the documentary, is if you want to reduce human shark conflict, key is not trying to change the behavior of sharks. Key is change the behavior of people. How do we reduce the chance, how do we reduce those situations where the shark can make a mistake? So when light levels are low, dawn and dusk, poor visibility, those kinds of things keep people out of the water during those times.
Yeah, and those shark spotters were awesome. Cliff with the flag spotting the sharks. It's so cool. And I guess it's one of the best ways to mitigate it on a coastline like that, like a massive coastline like it was.
Totally. And I love that they kind of, so many times around the world when you see human wildlife conflict, shark attack or elephant trample someone, the knee-jerk reaction is just kill the animal or even just kill that species. They don't even care, just sort of indiscriminate killing. And that's why this story that we covered in Sharks Up Close is so cool, because the community responded in a positive way. They were like, well, sharks are important for a healthy ecosystem, we're in their world. We also want to share the ocean. So how do we we don't want people to get eaten. So how do we create a system whereby we look after the sharks and we look after the people? And those shark spotters up on the cliffs, alerting people to a great white's presence, get people out of the water while the shark's in the area and then let them back in when it's gone. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And even those bronze sharks were just swimming under the surface. The surface had no idea. And you go, this is probably like 80 or 99% of the encounter, human shark encounters. It's just both
far
people.
More than 99%. I mean, you think between 5 and 10 people are killed by sharks each year. I mean, there are millions and millions of encounters between humans and sharks every single year. And those are, almost all, very, very good. And amazingly, the human often has absolutely no idea the shark is there.
Yeah, it's really cool. And will we see a part two where you finally get in the water with a big great white?
That's one of the benefits of not being able to do that is we get to try again. So yes, that would be cool. But actually, Sharks Up Close is a one-off special, and that's how we're kind of releasing all the animals up close going forwards rather than dropping a whole season. We're going to do them one at a time. So yeah, we've got a couple new ones coming soon. We've got dolphins and cheetahs next.
Oh, nice.
Which are bangers. And then, yeah, a bunch more after that that we're still filming now.
Nice. Looking forward to it. And oh, man, every time you get in the water with the whales, like, I start tearing up. Like, the fin whale one in the previous series was unreal. I want you to, like, are you going to do a whales up close, do you think?
That would be cool. Whales will feature again this season. I won't give away any more.
Awesome. Awesome. Looking forward to it. And you also did The Secret Life of Penguins this year, which took you to some wild places. What's a moment from behind the scenes that pushed you outside your comfort zone and also changed the way you see these birds?
Yeah, I mean, in the first episode that we did all about emperor penguins in Antarctica, yeah, a big part of that story was we wanted to show how penguins cope with, how they cope with storms. And as part of that, you need to go in the storm yourself. And yeah, we had this big storm come through, which the start of it is featured in the episode, when, yeah, the visibility goes to almost zero. We're following our blizzard lines, the ropes we lay between the tents so we can find our tents. And yeah, you know, that storm was pretty wild, 100 miles an hour. Our tents ripped, filled up with snow. We ended up having to abandon our camp and go and take shelter in these two abandoned shipping containers. And yeah, we spent 6 days in those containers waiting for the storm to pass. And that whole time I was cold and bored. And then I was like, hang on a second, the penguins have just been out in all of this. They don't hide in a shipping container, they just take it. Such amazing animals. Yeah, so tough. But at the same time, incredibly comical and clumsy. They're awesome animal of contrast.
Yeah, and that scene where they're jumping off the 50-foot cliff, what was going on there? That's the first time it's been recorded, right?
Yeah, that had never been filmed before. Yeah, that was unreal. I mean, the series is called Secrets of Penguins, right? And if you're going to call a series that, you need to find something no one's filmed before. So that way to end the first episode was such a relief. And amazing thing to see, but also a relief. It was like, you want a secret? Here's a penguin secret. Penguins base jumping. So yeah, that was pretty wild. Very lucky to see that.
Awesome. I have a few ending questions. What are some sacrifices you've had to make to pursue your dreams? And what's the side of your journey that people don't often get to see?
I'm starting to like try and change it now, but change sort of my priorities now. But yeah, I missed a lot of friends' birthdays and weddings and family stuff. And as I said, I think that's sort of what I chose to do when I was starting out, because very competitive industry, and you know, someone else will do it if you don't. So that's I guess kind of a sacrifice. But I mean, let's face it, in the grand scheme of things, it's not exactly a particularly dramatic sacrifice with what's going on in the world right now.
It's not the end of the world. And what advice you have for the young people who are going against the grain but haven't got the desired results yet?
Persistence, passion and persistence. Yeah. If you really love what you're doing, you know, it's the right thing to be doing. Just keep going. Because yeah, you gotta make that luck, and someone somewhere will be watching.
Definitely. And if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
That's a good question. 20-year-old self, this is advice, but like, I'd let him know that David Attenborough is really cool in real life. You know how people say you should never meet your heroes?
Yeah.
Those people haven't met David Attenborough.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you.
I don't know if that's advice, but like...
Yeah. Well, it's a heads up, isn't it?
Yeah. I think also, like, knowing that like teamwork and your mates is everything. And that's, I think, the really cool thing about filming wildlife as opposed to photographing it. Photographing it is a much more of a kind of solo endeavor, whereas filmmaking, like, you can't be good at all these things, and there's loads of jobs and roles to do. And yeah, that is the cool thing. You can be in the most amazing place if you're with a team you don't like. It's horrible. Meanwhile, you can be having the worst time, the worst weather, the animals not cooperating. But if you're with, you know, people that you really get on with, it's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And if you could film one extinct animal, what would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. One extinct animal, I don't know, like T-Rex or something. That'd be pretty sweet. I'm assuming we're not sort of involving any kind of safety considerations.
No, 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 yeah.
We're in total make-believe land. So yeah, I mean, T-Rex would be pretty sweet. Yeah, Stegosaurus, maybe. What's the one with the big swinging tail? Is that Bronk?
Is it one like the hammer tail kind of?
Yeah, Bronchosaurus. I should probably know that. Yeah. Any of those, they're sweet.
Yeah, that would be an awesome uncaged episode. But Greg, we're filming a
T-Rex. Dinosaurs, I'm close.
Yeah, without a cage. Do you have any mantras in your head that you repeat yourself when things are going tough, or if you're going through that persistence, grit kind of week in the field?
I think one of the great things about having done stuff for a while is you kind of gain experience, and not only do you have experience, but you sort of prove to yourself that you can do stuff, or, you know, stuff works out. And I think, yeah, biggest thing is, if you're passionate and you're persistent, Mother Nature might not give you what you want, but she'll give you something else that's probably better than what you wanted and you never expected. And that's sort of the magic of the job. I think the other thing is really, like, focus on what you can control. Like, worry about what you can control. Be aware of what you can't control, but don't worry about it. Because, like, I spent a lot of years getting really worried about weather. I'm really worried about whether an animal was going to do something. Just focus on what you can control. Be aware of the weather. Be aware of what the animal may or may not do. But focus on, you know, having your batteries charged, a memory card being in the camera, and your team being happy, and the rest kind of slots into place.
Yeah, that's very good stoic advice. Be, you know, just worry about what you can control. I'll definitely take that into account. And if you or your work could be remembered for one thing, what would it be?
Oh, I don't know. I just hope people get stoked about the natural world when they watch my documentaries and aware of some of the challenges that nature faces, and know that you might not feel very powerful as an individual if you're not, you know, a politician or CEO of a massive company, but you can, you know, positively affect the natural world. You know, if we could all just make our world a bit wilder, you know, that does make a difference. And you'll also see, like, quantifiable change, which is really cool. So, you know, whether you have a little garden or a big garden or the corner of your apartment, or you're involved in, like, a park down the road, like, help make that place wilder. You know, plant some trees, you know, plant some insect, you know, pollinator friendly flowers. And yeah, you'll see those, you know, buzzing bees come around. And yeah, not only will that make you feel warm and fuzzy inside, you'll see a positive change, but it also contributes towards getting us out of this mess that we've got ourselves in.
Yeah, big things start small, don't they? And even just in the sharks up close with the marine protected area, just having the whales and all the other life, not just the sharks, it shows it's living physical proof that it can work. And imagine if 30% or more of the oceans in our world was protected like that. Was it be amazing?
Totally, yeah. I mean, the great thing is that nature has an amazing ability to bounce back. We'd be in real trouble if it didn't. Nature can bounce back, give it the chance, and amazing things will happen.
Yeah. Bertie Gregory, ladies and gentlemen, Bertie, really, really appreciate this. This is an absolute honor. You're actually on my Mount Rushmore of dream podcast guests. So really appreciate it. And what are you currently working on? You mentioned it a little bit, but...
Couple secret projects, but then, yeah, next thing to come out is more animals up close. Yeah, dolphins up close, which we haven't announced the date yet, but it's coming soon. And then, yeah, a bunch of other stuff, but can't tell you about it, or Mickey Mouse will hunt us both down. Out of interest, who else is on the Mount Rushmore of podcasts?
Oh, I thought you'd ask that. So I've got David Yarrow. Have you heard David Yarrow, the photographer?
Familiar with his work, yeah.
Paul Nicklin, and then Chris Williamson from Modern Wisdom. Yeah, that's four. That's four people from other podcaster. Yeah.
Sweet. Well, I'll I'll tell Paul that he needs to come say hi. I'll send him a text after this.
Oh, much appreciated, mate. And where can people go if they want to find your work?
Best way to keep up with what I'm doing, latest stuff, is on Instagram at Bertie Gregory. I'm also on TikTok and all that fun stuff. And then, yeah, my shows are on Disney Plus. Animals Up Close, Epic Adventures, Secrets of the Penguins, Sharks Up Close. I'll keep you going for a while. Yeah, you'll be bored rigid of my face after all that. So yeah, hopefully you enjoy it.
Yeah, and where's your TED Talk gone? Did you do a TED Talk a few years ago?
Nope, never done a TED Talk. So yeah, if TED listening, I'm up for it.
Oh, I swear, I remember watching a talk that you did, and maybe it wasn't a TED Talk, but it was a really good talk, and I tried to find it on YouTube recently, and I don't know where it's gone. Oh, I mean, you've done a lot of live talks.
I used to do a lot of Geolive. That was like the speaking circuit, so maybe it was part of that, but no, never done a TED.
If there are any young wildlife filmmakers watching this, which there will be, check out Bertie's first Nat Geo series, Wild_Life. It's one of my favourites. It's still one of my favourites. I love it.
Back in the day.
Yeah, it's a classic. Yeah. Thanks very much. Thank you very much for coming on, Bertie. Really appreciate your time, and good luck with the rest of your work. And I'll be one of the first watchers for the new Up Close series.
Sounds good. All right, good chat.
If you want to start your own podcast but have no idea where to start, and you want to generate viral social media clips and get your dream guests onto your show, even from just using your laptop in your bedroom like I did, then my Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is exactly for you. It is a private paid course and community that has every single step and process I've used and continue to use to grow this show. And I include every single secret, every single tactic I do and still use that will get you results super fast. And also, if you want to access me personally every single week, then as part of this course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls where I go through your podcast and answer your questions to get you results much, much faster. So if you want to actually start a podcast and stop dreaming and get millions of social media views and book your dream guests in half the amount of time it took me, then click the first link in the description.